You know, the other day, I was watching a video. It was Thomas the Tank Engine. And Jacob was watching it with me, and my little grandson. And we were watching Thomas the Tank Engine. It was interesting, just before Thomas came on, we were doing whatever he was going to do with his various adventures. There was an advert. It was for Tomica Toys. Now, presumably, Tomica and Thomas are probably both copyrighted by the same people or something. But Tomica Toys, and these little plastic toys, that obviously the markup on these toys was absolutely phenomenal. And yet, looking at that advertisement, I thought, you know, just notice how this is actually tailored. It's tailored to children. Absolutely, totally, utterly tailored to children. If ever you watch children's television, and you go and you turn it on about, it's around about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, something like that, 4 till 5, something like this, and the advertisements that are between the programs that appear at that time, or on a weekend perhaps, where they reckon that an awful lot of children are watching, they are tailored specifically. There is big money in that, and they are tailored very specifically towards children to get that money off their parents. Because the idea is that if you can get the child to want something enough, then obviously that child will go and badger the parents, and you can go ahead and therefore increase your sales. From the British Computer Society small business website, under sales and marketing advertising, it says the following. It says, advertising is increasing sales and brand awareness are the desired results of a successful advertising strategy. How do you plan your campaign for maximum effect? How do you target the right audience and convey the right message? That's what advertising is all about. It's about trying to get people to go in your direction to make sure that you're going, they're wanting whatever it is that you've got to sell. They're going in your direction. What I want to do today is I want to talk about Satan's advertising campaign, Satan's media campaign, Satan's marketing campaign. You call it what you like, but basically the way that Satan has a media strategy. Now, I'm not going to deal with, you know, broadcasting in the spirit realm. I'm not going to talk about that, except to the side. But I want to talk about the way in which you will find him in the media generally. Out in the media. Television, books, magazines, articles. Just generally, you'll find this particular broadcast has influenced what we are watching, what we are seeing, what in fact is all around us today. Now, it really sparked to some degree by a quotation. I was looking for it, I couldn't find it, but over the last few weeks, Mr. Armstrong, in one of the tapes that we played, Mr. Armstrong made the quotation in one of the sermons that he gave, that today there's more opportunity to sin. Do you remember him giving that? How he said that? And I can't remember which one it was. I looked in that the Bible study on James, and I looked in another one, and I couldn't find it readily, so I can't quote it word for word. But he pointed out that today, because of the media, there is more opportunity to sin. You know, you'd have to go down to a brothel or something to look at some of the images that we are able to look at on our televisions, on newspapers and periodicals, on the internet or wherever. And there's just generally more opportunity to sin in the modern world. I've got 5 points I want to deal with. I want to talk about Satan's overall strategy, the overall strategy that's being used. Secondly, I want to talk about Satan's music campaign, the music campaign, because there is a strategy within music. Thirdly, I want to talk about the Satan's science and education campaign. You see, it's a marketing mix that he's using. He's using it within the media, and we are watching it. All of us, everyone in this room is watching this marketing mix. And we are being influenced by it. Every single last one of us in this room and over the internet are being influenced by it. So the science and education campaign. Satan's relationship campaign, I want to deal with fourthly. The relationship, because so often the relationships that are being portrayed within the media of all kinds are wrong, are false. And it is like a drip, drip, drip on us, and we know, don't realize so often. And yet that is there, the relationship campaign, I would say, is probably the major area. And finally, I want to talk about Satan's busy campaign. Now, I've labelled these in a slightly, I wouldn't say humorous way, but in a slightly unusual way, because that's really what, you could have all kinds of different areas. And I looked at the entire subject and I thought, how on earth do I fit all this into something like 5 points? Well, how do I break it down? How do you deal with it? Because it's all around us. We see it every day. And yet, how do we actually deal with it? How do we, go about bringing it to you? So let's go into this first point I want to deal with, the overall campaign. The overall campaign, in a large degree, is that we are being lied to. We are being lied to. And throughout this entire sermon today, I hope that we can see that. Turn over to Genesis 2. Let's start right in the beginning here in Genesis and just look at the example that is given to us. Genesis 3. What am I talking about? Genesis 3. And just notice this first media offensive that he had against Eve. Because really, what we're going to see within the media, generally, goes along these lines. And the serpent said to the woman, "You'll not surely die." So it's an outright lie. Well, you know, it is. Not immediately you wouldn't. You wouldn't immediately die, but eventually, "Dying you shall die," is what God said. "For God has knows that in the day that you eat thereof, your eyes will be open, and you'll be as gods, knowing good and evil." Notice there's a mixture of good and evil. It's the tree of good and evil. It's not just the tree of evil. So within the actual marketing mix that we will find good as well. And this is what makes the thing so poisonous to us. "And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food," so she was able to see it's good for food. And spirit, you know, within scripture, when you find food being mentioned, it's talking about knowledge. It's talking about something that you know in many cases. "And that it was pleasant to the eyes." It's something that is attractive, that we can see with our senses, or you know, perceive with our senses. "And a tree desired to make one wise." It's something that is desirable, and it looks on the surface, it looks good. "She took the fruit thereof, ate, and gave to her husband with her, and he ate." And so that was the first example that we'll actually find. But what we've got to understand is that Satan hasn't given up. If you turn over to Ephesians 6, just to remind ourselves, these are just the very basic scriptures. Just remind ourselves of what it says over in Ephesians 6. In Ephesians chapter 6, when we are looking at our television screens, when we are looking at our computer games, when we are looking at the various magazines, the books, the articles, listening to the radio, the media that comes into our mind from the world outside, we need to realize, verse 12, Ephesians 6, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood." What is behind this, in many cases, is not flesh and blood. This is coming from a source that is a spiritual source. "But against principalities and powers are the rulers of the darkness of this world, against wicked spirits in high places. Therefore take to yourself whole armour of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand." So when we're looking at this marketing mix, this media mix that Satan uses, again, let's just remind ourselves an overall campaign. Turn over to John chapter 8. John chapter 8. We find here in John chapter 8 a little about the subject of who we are dealing with. In John chapter 8, verse 42, Jesus said to them, he says, "If God were your Father, you would love me. For I proceed forth and came from God, neither did I come of myself, but he sent me." And in verse 43, "Why don't you understand my speech? Because you can't hear my word." You can't bear to hear what I've got to say. There is a complete and total barrier there between what is in the world and what God's standards are, how God's standards should be or are. He says, "You are of your father, the devil, and the lusts of your father you will do." So the same kind of mindset. Mr. Armstrong talked about it as a give mindset and a get mindset. But that is what's coming out in the media. And it comes out in so many subtle and varied ways. It's trying to, as Mr. Armstrong said, he said, it's so many opportunities to sin, to go off track, to go a different way. It says, the lust of your father he will do. He was a murderer from the beginning and did not live in the truth, because there's no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks of his own, for he is a liar and he's the father of it. And let's say, as we go through this subject, we will find that we are being lied to, continually lied to. And we have got to recognize this as we go through life. We've got to recognize as we pick up a book, a magazine, watch TV, watch videos, whatever we do, that there's mixed up with that, there's lying. And with our children as well, as parents, we have a responsibility. And grandchildren as well, we have a responsibility to be able to point them, to be able to help them also to overcome this, what in fact is out there that they are also seeing. Romans chapter 8, we're talking in the car actually coming over. Romans chapter 8, turn over to Romans 8. But we're talking in the car as we were coming over, just how profound a responsibility all of us have. I know Judy was saying that when Robin was born, and more than the other two, she'd obviously had experienced having other children, but when Robin was born, she saw this young baby as he was then. How's he growing? But this young baby of just a day or so old, and a totally blank slate of a mind that we then start to write on. That we as parents write on, we as grandparents write on, and every single individual that comes in contact with that child will begin writing on that mind, as does the media. And same with us, our minds are being written on by the media that we go ahead and put into it, allow into it. Now, we can't be pillar saints. You know what a pillar saint is, don't you? You know what a pillar saint is? No? Pillar saint. A pillar saint is one they used to find, they used to have these pillars. And on the top of the pillar sat a saint. And he would sit up there for years. And he'd pass his little bucket down and have food and water and bring it up. And he was supposed to be righteous by being a pillar saint, by cutting himself off from everything and everybody. And I think one of them, I think, they used to be up there for something like 40 years. I mean, just beyond. You know, the mind boggles in certain areas. You don't want to walk underneath. But anyway, Romans chapter 8, verse 7. It says, because the carnal mind, and the media that we have from the world is coming from a carnal mind. The carnal mind is enmity against God. It is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be, so that they that are in the flesh cannot please God. It cannot. It's coming from a different source. It's coming from a different way. You're actually getting information coming in from a different source. Now, it's not going to be all evil. It is going to be a mixture, but it's going to be a deadly mixture. So in that mixture, you'll find good, and yet it's the sorting of it out which is so difficult. Let's turn over to Christ's instruction, or his prayer, to just remind ourselves of his prayer regarding ourselves in John 17. In John 17, Christ praised the Father, and he talks about each and every one of us in our relationship to the media, to the world. He says in verse 11, John 17, verse 11, and now I'm no more in the world, but these are in the world, and I come to you, Holy Father. Keep through your own name those who you have given me, that they may be one as we are. It's interesting, it says, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together, so much the more as you see the day approaching, because that is going to be important, that we remain one as the Father and Christ are. While I was with them in the world, I kept them in your name. Those that you gave me have I kept, and none of them is lost but the son of perdition, that the scripture might be fulfilled. And now I come to you, and these things I speak in the world, that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. I pray not that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil, or the evil one. It's a case of turning our eyes from seeing evil. It's a case of switching off the box. It's a case of doing what is necessary, you know, ripping out the pages if necessary of magazines. I remember one particular time, and this was over in Radlett, the press. In the press in Radlett, you have to be careful. You know, you go onto a farm sometimes, and you've got to be careful where you put your foot. You've got to look where you're putting your feet. Well, in Radlett, as you came out of the press, you must be very careful that you did not look where you put your feet. And the reason for that is right next to the press in Radlett was Hunter Print. And Hunter Print printed pornographic material. And this stuff used to blow across the entire forecourt. So you had to be careful where, you know, that you didn't go and look down where you were putting your feet, because this stuff was blowing around in the wind. Now, if we go down to verse 15, I pray not that you should take them out of the world, but you should keep them from the evil one. We've got to be discerning. We've got to watch where we put our feet. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them. Here's the answer. Sanctify them. Set them apart through your truth. Your word is truth. So, that in fact is the overview. If we look at the overview of the campaign, it is a case that Satan, we are wrestling against wicked spirits. They're in high places. They are influencing the media that gets through to us. And we need to be aware of that. It is not just coming from human beings. It is human beings that have a certain influence. And we need to recognize that, and recognize that we're not battling against the human being. We're battling against a spiritual force behind that. And when we see certain things on television, don't be surprised. And as we go towards the end time, don't be surprised as this media mix becomes progressively worse. We are going to have to deal with this. And we're going to have to deal with it within the church, with our families, in every way. So let's deal with one of these areas. And the first one I want to deal with is music. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. Now, if you want to put in your notes, Colossians 3:16, it talks about the words of Christ, and then talking about the Psalms. But if we look at the subject of music, I just want to notice what it says over here in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15. It says, "See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. Therefore do not be unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is. Don't be drunk with wine which is in excess, but be filled with the Spirit of God, speaking to yourself or speaking among yourselves in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, and giving thanks always for all things to God and the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ." Now that's the instruction that we have. That's coming out from Paul. It's the one way in which they were, in fact, to memorize Scripture. And if you read around that verse, now these three things, psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, they are not secular. They are categories of psalms. And I think I brought this out before. The word psalm is literally psalm. It means to twang. The word spiritual song is hymn, hymnos. And it's something like a shout. It's a shout or a rejoicing psalm. And the word for, hymns. Hymns is hymnos, I beg your pardon. Spiritual song is ode in Greek. And the word ode is more of a almost like a chant. It was more of a structured, a certain rhythm that would come out. It's a rapping, the rapper of the Psalms, basically. But these are three categories of psalm, three kinds of psalm, in which the words of the psalms were being memorized. Now, the question is, what was the psalm music like? Because when you're looking at the music that comes over, is coming across in many different ways. It's not just we sit down and listen to music. When you turn on the television set, when you see a romantic scene, what happens? The music comes on. Are you aware of that? Are we aware of what's actually being done? We are being manipulated by music today. You see two people in bed together, the music is playing, and the music carries a message that this is fine, this is beautiful, this is lovely. Even though he may be in bed with somebody else's wife, the music takes the message into us. This is why I started with this. Because music is such that it gets to our heart, it gets to the heart and core. The lyrics also of the music are carried on the music. They're carried into our being, and they stay there. We can't get rid of them. So we've got to be careful as we listen, what we listen to. Because it will have an effect. And we need to be aware of this, and need to be aware that this is part of the marketing mix. And it is a satanic marketing mix by men who are under a certain influence. I'm not talking about possession in most cases, but I'm talking about influenced. It is a mix which is designed to... who is Satan trying to get at? Satan is trying to get at us. Those who are trying to go God's way, that it will replace him. Be aware of the marketing side of music. Turn over to Psalm. Psalm 16. What am I talking about, Psalm 16? It should be 1 Kings 16. Samuel, not to bring it up. 1 Samuel 16. Is that right? Yes, 1 Samuel 16, give me. I put Psalms in my notes. So 1 Samuel 16, 1 Samuel 16. Here is Saul having a problem. Now remember, David, I've just done various Bible studies on canonization. The second canonization period, you're looking at David and Solomon. And what happened then was the actual the start of the temple worship, the expansion from the tabernacle, and the psalms. Many of the psalms were put together, and they were put together by David. He was the one that implemented the music to be played with these psalms. I want you to notice what type of music he used, and this is the type of thing that should have been accompanying the psalms, the hymns, the spiritual songs that we just read back in Ephesians 5. Down here in 1 Samuel 16, verse 14, "But the spirit of the Eternal departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Eternal," or God allowed this evil spirit, "troubled him. And Saul's servant said to him, Behold, now an evil spirit sent from God troubles you. Let our Lord now command your servants, which are before you, to seek out a man who is a cunning player on a harp. And it will come to pass that when this evil spirit from God, or evil breath from God, is upon you, that he will play with his hand, and you will be well." This must be soothing, quiet, uplifting music. It could only be that. "And Saul said to his servants, Provide me now a man that can play well, and bring him to me. And they answered, One of the servants said, Behold, I've seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, that is cunning in playing, and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and comely person, for the Eternal is with him." So when exactly this occurred, I'm not sure, whether it was before Goliath or after Goliath. It appears to be almost after Goliath. But "Therefore Saul sent messages to Jesse and said, Send me David your son, which is with your sheep. And he took his bread And it came to pass when the Spirit from God was upon Saul, verse 23, David took a harp, played with his hand, so Saul was refreshed. So this music was refreshing. It was uplifting. It was something which allowed, you know, which gave a different type of spirit, a different type of mind, and it helped the mental process of Saul. And was well, and the evil spirit departed from him. So this depression, or whatever it was that was there, went away. And we can see, therefore, that the style that David would have played the Psalms couldn't have been radically different. It must have been similar. It must have been uplifting. It was something which produced, I mean, he is worshipping God as well, and you look at the words of some of these Psalms, then it is an uplifting. The words are uplifting, even in the sad Psalms. You get something which is sad, which you know, all right, it's a mournful tune, but there are uplifting endings to them. And you can look at the Psalms and you will find that that in fact is something that was implemented within the very temple services themselves. Now if we go back and look at what is happening today, and let's turn back to Genesis 4, because coming from the marketing mix, there is something that is as old as the hills as far as Satan is concerned. What we are looking at as far as the media is concerned, this aspect of music, it goes back a long way. Genesis chapter 4 verse 21, it says his brother's name, okay, now Ada bare Jabal, and he was the father of such as dwell in tents, and his brother's name was Jubal. That's Genesis chapter 4 verse 21. He was the father, or the teacher, of all such that handle or pervert the harp and the organ. And Zillah also dwelt, Tubal Cain, the instructor of every artificer in brass. And you say, well, how can you say that that is twisting music? How can you say that that verse really is telling us that it's a twisting of music? Well, what you do is you go back to Josephus. And Josephus elaborates a little bit on this particular subject. In Antiquities of the Jews, book 1, chapter 2, concerning the posterity of Adam and the 10 generations from him to the deluge. I want to just read this. He says, when Cain had travelled over many countries, he, with his wife, built a city named Nod, which is a place so called, and there he settled his abode, where he also had his children. However, he did not accept of his punishment in order to amendment, but to increase his wickedness. So you're looking at Cain increasing in wickedness, according to what Josephus said. And he had actually access to records that we don't have today. Library in Alexandria was burned. He has a great deal of information that we don't have today. Talking about this Jubal, it says he exercised himself in music and invented the psaltery and the harp. So we're looking at this individual, presumably the bagpipes, the psaltery, I believe, is what he was, and the harp. But the next comment, the comment at the bottom of this paragraph, it says, even while Adam was alive, it came to pass, the posterity of Cain became, notice, exceedingly wicked, every one successively dying, one after another, more wicked than the former. So this was a progression, according to what Josephus tells us, that the wickedness of Cain was becoming worse and worse, and it was this is part of the reason why you had the problems when you get to the days of Noah. It was a progressive wickedness that was on the earth. They were intolerable in war, vehement in robberies. If anyone was slow to murder people, yet he was bold in the profligate behavior, in acting unjustly and doing injury for gain. So that's what Josephus tells us about this period. And this is why, when generally within the church, when we've read verse 21 here of Genesis 4, it's not a case of just being a father of all such that handle the harp and play the harp and the organ. It's talking about twisting it, about perversion of it, because he's well down the generations from Cain. The thing that we need to do is to make sure that we ask ourselves, as we listen to music, if we're listening to music specifically, what is this really producing within me? If we are watching a scene on a film and the music is in the background, don't just push it in the background and get rid of it. Ask, well, what's it doing? What's it actually telling I remember seeing Ozzy Osbourne. I remember seeing a program of Ozzy Osbourne. Now, it should tell you something that the group backing Ozzy Osbourne is Black Sabbath. I mean, that should tell us something. But you know, in his, the little bit I saw, they showed the crowds and had some of his gigs, and the fellas used to go around there pushing and thumping each other because of the music. And to get to that stage of music, Ozzy Osbourne would actually spend half an hour in the dressing room before he came out. He'd come out and he would actually, you saw a picture of him actually coming out towards the stage, and nobody was to talk to him or do anything, because he'd spend half an hour working himself up in the dressing room into this angry, you know, hopeless, you know, vehement idea. And we look, you know, we look at this. Let's turn over to Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5. In Galatians chapter 5. As Mr. Armstrong points out, there are two different ways. There's a way of give, there's a way of get. They're opposed to each other. Within music, there are also two different ways. There's a way which is uplifting, and there's a way that tears down. Even the way that's uplifting can be used in a wrong way, and we must be aware of these things. In Galatians chapter 5, in verse 16, it says, "Then I say to you, walk in the Spirit, and you will not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit against the flesh. These are contrary one to another, so you cannot do the things that you would. But if you're led of the Spirit, you're not under the law. You're not under the penalty of the law." Again, it's like a way of life. If you walk down that way, the law tells you, it gives you the knowledge of sin. The sin is on either side. It tells you that you're off track. It doesn't get you back on track. But if you walk in that way, the way of being led by the very Spirit of God, you will not need to be under the law, because the law will be kept automatically. It will be kept. This is why it's so important. If we want to overcome something, we get in contact with God. That's the way in which we overcome. It's the contact with God allows us then to have the strength to overcome. We can't do it on our own strength. "But the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred." You go through this list and you listen to some of the modern music and you find this is what comes out. And yet, on the other side, the fruit of the Spirit, and it's all a collective thing: love, joy, peace, patience, gentleness, goodness, faith. That should be coming across. And we are affected by what we listen to, because music does get through to the heart. All right, let's have a look at this other another section then. Let's have a look at science and education, this marketing mix. Again, being lied to. Turn back to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. So often when we have newspaper articles, we want to watch a nature program. What's the first thing that comes in? It's evolution. From start to finish. Why? Because it is undermining faith. And this steady drip, drip, you think, well, am I missing something? You know, you appear as a total oddball. But Romans chapter 1, verse 18, it says, "For the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth," or withhold the truth, hold back the truth, "in unrighteousness." This is a deliberate thing. We've got to be aware of this. They are deliberately pushing the evolutionary concept, and it's being done deliberately. It is not something that is, you know, oh, just happens to be. "Because that which is known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. If they opened their eyes, they would see. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, understood by the things that are made, if they look with open eyes at the things that are made. Even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." In this area, they're without excuse. And if you go and read this section, it then it talks about professing themselves to be wise, verse 22, they became fools, and they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made of corruptible man and beast. And we're looking at the modern system that we see today. But notice down in verse 28, it says, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. And it's interesting, the word knowledge there is epinosis. Now, when you look at 1 Timothy 6:20, if you want to put it in your notes, 1 Timothy 6:20, where it says, science, falsely so called, gnosis is the word used there, translated as science. Epinosis means higher science. You can read this, and even as they did not like to retain God in their higher science, their higher knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not proper. And he goes into the list that is there. You may think, well, it's probably stretching the point a little bit. I want to read you certain things here. First of all, from an article called The Game of Science by a man called Richard Dickinson. He says, science fundamentally is a game. It's a game with one overriding and defining rule. Rule number one, let us see how far and to what extent we can explain the behavior of the physical and material universe in terms of purely physical and material causes without invoking the supernatural. Isn't that illuminating? Huxley. Aldous Huxley, now you probably know Aldous Huxley because he wrote Brave New World. I don't know how many of you have read Brave New World, but it's quite a fascinating book. But Aldous Huxley, he was the grandson of Thomas Huxley, and he was the brother of Julian Huxley. Now Thomas Huxley was actually known in social circles as Darwin's bulldog. He was the one that pushed what Darwin's theory had to say. That was his grandfather. And here was Aldous Huxley. It says, I had motives, and this is a quote from his report. It says, Confessions of a Professed Atheist. I had motives for not wanting the world to have meaning. Consequently, I assumed it had none, and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in pure metaphysics. He's also concerned to prove that there's no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do. And he goes on a bit further. He says, for myself, as no doubt to most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation. The liberation we desired was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system, in other words, the standards that were there within our society, and liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. So they accept evolution because if you go down the road of accepting a God, you if somebody who creates reality also creates morality. The two go hand in glove, they go hand together. I won't go into the... It's interesting, it says, Abraham Lincoln said that the philosophy of the classroom in one generation becomes the philosophy of the government in the next. That was Abraham Lincoln that said that, and it is absolutely true. The philosophy in the classroom has become the philosophy of the government, of the media today. That is why what was in the classroom earlier on is now on television, broadcast openly, with David Attenborough, educating the entire population, trying to get the whole lot on board. It's interesting that it says, Hitler stressed and singled out the idea of biological evolution as the most forceful weapon against traditional religion, and he repeatedly condemned Christianity for its opposition to the teaching of evolution. For Hitler, evolution was the hallmark of modern science and culture, and he defended its veracity as tenaciously as Haeckel. And that was from A Scientific Origins of National Socialism. There's an article there. But we know that, you know, when you put in your notes Psalm 33, verse 6 to 9, it's by the word of God that the heavens were made. And it's the breath of his mouth that all things consist. And we go back to that, and we go back to that foundation, and we hold on to that foundation. But you see, what's happening in the media is an undermining all the time. It's an undermining. I'd like to show you an article. This was in Wednesday's Daily Mail. Judy bought it for me. See the picture? The picture here is of an ape man. Okay? And over here, Fred Flintstone's Beast of a Feast 500,000 years ago. So somebody had a lot of understanding. And now this drawing of all the goings on at this particular place that they found over in somewhere in Britain. Where was this? It's interesting that it says here it's preserved like Pompeii. That's the subheading down here. It's preserved like Pompeii. And the indication, anybody reading this says, oh yes, there we are, and we'll skip over it. Top of the food chain is another subheading. Secret experts uncover the startling secrets of Britain's oldest human inhabitants, including a family picnic. Do you know what they've actually found? Right in the heart of the article, right in the heart of the article, if you go and read it all, excavations at the quarry, on which English Heritage has spent more than £1 million over the last 10 years, uncovered a massive shin bone belonging to an adult male. That's one of these bones. I got two bones in my shin. Okay, one of them, a shin bone. An adult male, Mark Roberts, another of the archaeological team at UCL, said analysis of the bone showed a Box Grove man was about 52 when he died, surprisingly old. So from one shin bone, what else have they found? Two front teeth, which belonged to another adult, were also unearthed. So from one shin bone and two front teeth, you have this article. That is the sum total. Now, they did find certain flints and various bits and pieces like that, but essentially the actual bones were one shin bone and two front teeth. Now, be aware, there's so much conjecture. Walking with dinosaurs, walking with cavemen, you know, walking with the Munros and the Bulls, or whatever it might be. Yeah. You wonder what the next thing is. Okay, let's read another one. Another one we've got here. Before we do that, let's read a scripture. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Is that one on? Yeah. It says verse 3, 2 Corinthians chapter 10, here's the instruction that we have given by God. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. That's not where the battle is being fought. The media is being fought in our minds from what we see, what we read. It's not just a broadcast that comes over spiritually that somehow infiltrates our mind. That's there as well. That's why it's so important that we get on our knees each day, every morning. In fact, the whole thing is all to do with prayer and to do with contact with God. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. Understanding that these strongholds are being erected by people deliberately. Casting down imaginations or thoughts or reasoning and every high thing that exalts itself against the science of God. That word knowledge is a science. It's translated science over in 1 Timothy 6 verse 20. It's gnosis. Same word. It's against the science of God and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Christ created this earth. And when we're looking at what we have thrown at us through the media, I always remember one thing that happened over at the dig. That's the dig down at Jerusalem. And this sticks in my mind as the idea that science is above trying to push its own ideas. If this man's name was Isaac, basically, he's a Jewish archaeologist. And we brought him this piece of pottery. And he said, look, we just dug this up. And he looked at it and says, "Oh no," he said, "this shouldn't be found there." And he threw it down into another area to be found. And we thought, but we just dug it out of that area. Yeah, but I mean, that's not where it's found. It's found down there. But the fact that this piece of pottery probably lasted all through the generations or whatever, a thousand years or whatever, and was still being used in Moshe's household so many generations later and happened to get broken and be left in, say, Byzantine times, or whatever it happened to be. I can't even remember what the layers were, but I remember him deliberately throwing it down into another area because it didn't fit his theories. This happens. I remember talking to my brother who was in a university, and this, I was talking about the language of the educated, and he says, yes, he says, you know, all these kind of articles that appear, they're trying to impress other scientists, other professors. That is what they're trying to do. It's a bit of a game, as he says. It's I've read this quotation to you: science is fundamentally a game. A game with one overriding and defining rule. Rule number one: no God. You cannot have any God. That's rule number one. Before you go in any of it, before you start playing the game at all. I remember seeing a program about pelicans. Do you see that one? And they pushed this idea, and they had this idea that pelicans basically they lay two or three eggs, and then you finally have this confrontation, and one pelican pushes the other pelican out of the nest. You saw these two pelicans fighting, and one gets pushed out of the nest. One survives, the other one dies. Now, I don't know. Maybe they do. Maybe that is the way it is, because it is red in tooth and claw. I know that. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if that is not the way it works. In the vast majority of cases, I wouldn't be surprised if either some adults manage to rear two or other adults, there's natural attrition, and there is not this kind of this is the way in which it was portrayed on the television. Monkeys with homosexual tendencies. Seen anything like that? Have you seen these kind of articles and things that have been appearing recently? Why are they doing that? Ask ourselves why. Read what Huxley said. Liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. And therefore, he believes in evolution because it allows him to do what he wants. Why are they doing this? Why are they saying these things? In 2 Peter, turn over to 2 Peter 3. And as we review the various things that we look at, the media that is coming into our homes, the media that's coming into our minds, we have got to be aware of things like this. Notice, that's the 1 Peter, 2 Peter chapter 3. It says, verse 5, it says, "For this they are willingly ignorant." They are willingly ignorant. Here again, people are willingly ignorant. "That by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water. The world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth which are now, by the same word, are being kept in store, reserved to fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." The word that they so casually dismiss, the word that upholds all that exists, if they'd only just open their eyes, that same word also has given the outcome as well. Interesting that when you look at parallel universes, the only evidence, I wonder, this article here, "The Origin of Artificial Species." It says, "Scientists study how our organs evolved by watching millions of years of natural selection unfold on a computer." And people swallow it, hook, line and sinker. "At one end of creation lies a chaotic jumble of atoms and molecules, the building blocks of matter. At the other are many ordered miracles of biological construction, such as a brain or an eye or a heart. And even for a hardcore rationalist, it's hard to visualize how the fantastically complexity of nature can be created by the blind forces of evolution." Too right. It jolly well is. But that is the opening to this article. And it goes on. Buried in the article, I want you to notice this. It says, and how did it come into... Sorry, the same approach that we now take to explore the evolution of organs. How did something so complicated as a human eye, with so many interacting parts, come into being? And a human eye isn't as good as a hawk's eye. A hawk eye is, you know, even better. How did it come into being? Not once, but many times. So as they study the fossil records, you just listen to what it says. Eyes have evolved independently at least 40 times. If they rationally look at the fossil record, eyes have come into being 40 separate occasions. Does that sound logical to you? In 40 separate occasions, buried into this article, in the 4 billion years that life has existed on the planet. You see, even that opening statement, this chaotic jumble of atoms and molecules, do you understand just what we are in? Even just the universe that we're in. It's not just complex. It is so finely poised. It is so finely, delicately balanced. And they know, absolutely, categorically know, that if certain things, certain constants are changed ever so slightly, like gravity, like the expansion of the universe, you wouldn't have solar systems, you wouldn't have planets, you'd have nothing that would allow a life even to evolve, let alone to exist at all. It's got to be the way it is, down to a molecular and a atomic and subatomic level. It is designed that way, so that we exist. How do we get around that one? Oh, the parallel universes. Because if you've got an infinite number of parallel universes, we just happen to be one of an infinite number. There is not the slightest shred of evidence for that at all. That is how they get around it. And yet here, this one, this article, gives the impression that, it's just a jumble of atoms. Baloney. Total, utter baloney. We are being lied to. And as we evaluate the media that comes into our minds, we have got to recognize that. And it is not just being lied to the fact that evolution caused certain animals to exist. It is the fact that we are being lied to in the way in which certain things occur. I think I was going to actually deal with that somewhere in amongst this lot. I'll come to that in a minute. But the way in which, as I said, these homosexual tendencies within monkeys, how many months or years have they sat there waiting to go ahead and actually witness this act? And you see two monkeys that are doing whatever over on a branch somewhere. How do you know whether they are or they aren't? You have no idea. No idea. But we're told that. Why? Because they want to justify their own positions. And we have got to be aware of this. The immorality, they're trying to justify immorality within society by saying, oh, well, it's natural for you to sow your genes. And they are justifying, and it is continual, and it is dripping, and it is influencing not ourselves, but our children as well. And we've got to be aware of what in fact is happening, that there's a marketing mix, it is a media mix that is taking place, and we are in the middle of it, and we are being influenced by it, and we have got to see the good and the evil. We've got to be able to sift through it. It's the word of God that helps us to do that. The Spirit of God is essential for it. We've got to keep close to God, and it is so important that these things are done. All right, what about Satan's relationship campaign? I mean, this just goes on and on. I mean, we can have all kinds of ideas. Here's one. Babies do not suffer if mothers go to work. This is a headline, okay, from this past week. I think it's past week, is it? May the 13th, okay? Babies don't suffer. Headline yesterday, passive smoking isn't as bad as we thought. The fact that it was actually organised by a tobacco company, the fact that, you know, what else was there? Some other areas as well that were very, very suspect. The actual analysis was only for 1970-something, or 70-something, wasn't it? They're trying to base this on. All right, the same kind of thing, this relationship campaign. Women storm the sumo wrestling ring. Why? No, this is the woman, that's a bloke. Okay, but this, I mean, why on earth would a woman want to become a sumo wrestler? You see, eat what you like, probably, but... it is subtle. It is not so subtle in many cases. It is anything but subtle. But you see the kind of tips of the iceberg, but underneath is all kinds of subliminal levels as well, that we are being influenced. Now, how do we know? This particular subject really was just incredibly difficult to kind of organize in any way. I'm hoping that I can give it in some kind of an organized way. Let's take another one. Equality of the sexes. Have you noticed on the news? It was the Ark Royal came in, I think, last night, yesterday afternoon or whatever, came back from the Gulf. Of the, how many thousand, I don't know, how many hundreds of people, thousands of people on the Ark Royal ship? I mean, how many people on the Ark Royal? It must be several hundred, if not thousands, on that ship. Who do they interview? Who gets all the time? It is a woman naval officer who's maintaining something down below decks. Why? There's nothing wrong interviewing a woman or a man. But they are trying to push something. They are trying to push an equality of the sexes. In other words, women, it's quite perfectly okay for women to do this type of work. And you need to be aware of this kind of thing. Turn over to Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11. Now, I plan to play a tape from Mr. Herbert Armstrong next week. And in it, he makes a comment on race relations, basically. And he brings out this particular point here in Genesis chapter 11. He'll elaborate on it a great deal. But again, within this media mix, we also need to be aware that we are being influenced by this, by the idea that racial integration is the good thing and racial segregation is bad. That is what the basic message is coming across. But in Genesis chapter 11 verse 1 it says the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And you go down to verse 4, it says, and they said, go and let us build a city and a tower whose top may reach to heaven. Let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. The problem was that they were coming down, they were travelling east. It says, came to pass, not they journeyed from the east, they journeyed towards the east, because they landed on Ararat and journeyed towards the east. And they came to Shinar, and there they built this tower, and they made this name to stop them being scattered abroad. They're trying to integrate the races, integrate the nationalities that were there. And we go down to verse 8, it says, so the Eternal scattered them abroad from there upon the face of the earth, and they left to build a city, and therefore the name is called Babel, because the Eternal there confounded the language of the earth, and from there the Eternal scattered them abroad upon the face of the whole earth. God segregated them. Now that is just one instance, and as I say, Mr. Armstrong will deal with that. But what do we have? Ethnic cleansing is the height of something that's absolutely vile. Now the way it's done is vile, but the concept is not. The concept is godly, that we clean the areas up ethnically. We are going to do that in the millennium. There will be ethnic cleansing by God, not the way it's implemented today. Apartheid, separateness, that's what it means separateness. That is a godly principle. Now, the way it was actually applied was wrong, but the actual concept was correct. Now, remember the thing that really sticks in my mind And this really sums up the this concept. It was a time when South Africa was apartheid was still in force, and I talked to a relative of mine, a lady, whose daughter was getting married, and marrying somebody who I personally I had no time for. It was immoral, as far as I was concerned, and it proved the marriage didn't last at all. It lasted a very, very short period of time. And I said to her, I said, you know, I don't think the guy's moral. She said to me, of course he's moral. He doesn't buy South African oranges. And that was the way in which she determined the morality. It was whether he bought South African oranges or not, because apartheid was on the go at that time. Now, we need to be aware that there is a subliminal message within the media. It is affecting us. And even now, when I say ethnic cleansing and apartheid, to us here within this room, we have been affected by that. Apartheid means separateness. It means that the races are separate. It doesn't mean that one is above another at all. It purely means, I think it's an Afrikaans word that means separate, as far as I know. But the concept of coffee-coloured people by the score, which is an old Beatles song, part of a Beatles song, as far as I remember. I think it was Beatles, was it? Years ago. But coffee-coloured people by the score is not godly. It is not the way God designed things. You look out in nature. What does he have? He has variety. Huge variety. You don't have coffee-coloured people by the score. Okay, so there's one area that this kind of relationship campaign, this relationship campaign of Satan in the media. What about the emotional, the emotional areas in there? Now, what about, I've mentioned before, as far as drama is concerned, you have the soaps, where everything has got to be above and beyond anything as far as drama is concerned. People within society ape that and mimic it, and will then cause the soap to go up a notch, and people mimic that, so it goes up another notch. And this is why we have such absolute craziness in many cases within society, because people are aping the soaps and that kind of thing. I was talking to Mr. Hancock, actually, I think it was a couple of weeks ago. He was talking about Zed cars and the Sweeney, because he was in the police, he was in the police force. He said, you know, when the Sweeney came on, and they all wore leather jackets and all had this kind of, drove these fast cars, all CID suddenly started wearing leather jackets and driving fast cars. Why? Because that's what the CID is. That's how the CID operates. And they behave like the Sweeney. I think he was on the beat at the time. Whether that's got anything to do with it or not, I don't know. But it's interesting, but that is true. What about Grange Hill? Do you remember, is Grange Hill still running? It's still running. Boy, they must be old by now. But Grange Hill was about the same time as the Z cars over in kind of 60s time, something like that. Grange Hill was, as far as the actual conduct, I mean, there was a great furore about the conduct within the classroom being portrayed in Grange Hill, and they justified it. But you see, what's happened? It's gone up a notch. It's gone up a notch. And we have now, people being injured within, teachers being injured within classrooms. Teachers being killed. What's his name? Lawrence. Being killed. Now, let's take some other, let's turn over to, I think let's skip that one. Let's have a look at, say, Anne Robinson. It's Anne Robinson, isn't it? The one that does Weakest Link, isn't it? Yeah. But Anne Robinson, what does she say? I mean, it's a case of, you're the weakest link, goodbye. Rude, abrasive, drives me insane. Absolutely. Just horrible. I mean, what kind of a role model? But you can guarantee that is having an effect on the society today. Our role model is being undermined. Do you know, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Remember this thing? Do you know how many that was watched by? 13 million. Half the British audience watched that film. I don't know whether you noticed, but on the news on Channel, was it 3, isn't it? ITV. They had this thing on the news. Two, three nights in a row. It's insane. And yet, that is actually, it is having an effect. Now, why is that having an effect? What is it that's behind this emotional kind of blackmail almost, this media mix? What is undergirding this idea of Big Brother, survival of the fittest? It's evolution again. The concept of evolution is seeping into that area. I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. I think it's something similar, you know, the one gets chopped out and chucked away or whatever. It's the same kind of thing. You know, you are the weakest link, goodbye. You know, you go away with nothing and this one survives. All to do with evolutionary theory. It is evolutionary theory that is subtly being put across. That is what is coming across. Another article here. How I discovered the beast within. A very attractive young lady. Our sexual behaviour is rather pedestrian when you look at other species. Apparently, biologist Olivia Judson has taken America by storm thanks to her sex-obsessed alter ego and the mating habit of spoonworms. Now, let me tell you what the way... I mean, the idea is brilliant. I mean, the idea she has is absolutely brilliant. Let me read you a little bit from her book. Full marks for creativity. Dear Tatiana, I'm a queen bee and I'm worried. All my lovers leave their genitals inside me and then drop dead. Is this normal? Okay? So it's an agony ant for all these different species. As I say, creatively, it really is. It looks wonderful. But it goes on. I'm astonished when people say that they're opposed to sexual education or that they do approve of it and then advise abstinence to young people. It's not practical to hush it up or to tell people about it and then say don't do it. That just goes against nature. So what about her own love life? Has it changed the result of her studies? It's made it easier to let out the beast within. Now do you see? You see, on the surface, the idea is brilliant. You know, it's presenting it in a humorous way, an agony ant for all these different creatures. And isn't that just typical? But the underlying message is evil. And it is corrupting ourselves and our children. And it is one part of a media mix. It is a satanic media mix. Okay, we'll go into the area of morality then. If I'm not careful, I'm going to run out of time, but anyway. Let's turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. You see, morality, Satan does not have sex. Therefore, he's sexless. And if there's anything that he'd like to destroy, it is that area. Marriage and sex. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 in verse 3 it says, Paul says, but I fear lest by any means, as the serpent beguiled Eve through his subtlety, so your minds should be corrupted from the simplicity that's in Christ. For if he that comes preaches another Jesus whom you have not preached, or if you receive another spirit, notice these are coming from spiritual sources. The media mix that's being used against us is coming from a spiritual source, which you have not received, or another gospel, something that's good, some good news that you have not accepted. You may well bear with him. Now, he's talking about certain spiritual matters there, but these matters are spiritual. The undermining of the fact that God is a creator, the undermining of the fact that we are to be a chaste virgin to marry to Christ. For I'm jealous over you with a godly jealousy. I've espoused you to one's husband that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. That is in verse 2. That's the reason why there is sex. That's the reason why Satan is attacking this particular area. To give you an idea, I've got today's paper here. You've got an article in it about Islam. Radical Shiite cleric warns women not to consort with US soldiers. It says the burning of cinemas will be permitted, he said on Friday prayers, if their owners continue to show indecent films. Okay. And this has been condemned, of course, in the West. It says they're receiving warnings from armed gangs to remove sultry posters outside their premises. Saddam's orders warned Christian women that they should follow Islamic principles in covering themselves when in public. And it's presented in a negative way. In the same paper, we have Anne Summers complaining that their job centre ban is, basically the sex manuals and the vibrators and all the rest of it, that the job centres won't allow them to go ahead and advertise there to recruit staff. And another one, Miriam and Walters make a splash with the WI calendar girls. Now I want you to just read this. It says, Helen Mirren elegantly rolled up her pinstripe trousers, held hands with Julie Walters and paddled in the sea off Cannes yesterday amid signs that their latest film, Calendar Girls, in which they appear naked, is set to follow the full Monty into British film history. His movie about the jam-making ladies of Rylstone Women's Institute in Yorkshire Dales, who strip off for charity, is the most enchanting British picture in years. It has the feel and the magic of the days when the British filmmakers were recreating stories of the English countryside, like the Railways Children. Okay? Do you see what I'm talking about? It is trying to portray something which is wrong, and it's giving it this gloss. You know, if you're watching, I can guarantee you something. When this happens, if it's an enchanting, lovely scene or whatever, listen to the music. Listen to the music and be aware of what the producer is doing. He is manipulating your mind. And it is not coming from the producer, it's coming from a spirit that pervades all society. We have got to be aware of this. We have got to be guarding against it individually and for our children as well. Homosexuality. Homosexuality is accepted today. It's accepted across the board. And yet, you know, again, talking to Chris a couple of weeks ago, he had somebody working with him that when he told him that 35 years ago, anybody who was caught as a homosexual or practicing homosexual went to prison. 135 years ago, they were killed, they were hanged. The guy wouldn't believe him. He didn't understand that this could possibly be the case. And yet that is the case. That is what happened. Our society has changed dramatically. God's system is not what we have got today. And yet what do we have? We have an article like this one here. Barrymore is back, but only in New Zealand. And he pulled the press photographer on stage, taped him into a chair, gagged him and placed a placard in front of him reading, "Thou shalt not lie." Okay, this is what he did to this press photographer. Stuck him on a stage and humiliated him in front of everybody. Among the first night audience was Sean Davies, the New Zealander Barrymore, quote, married in a gay ceremony in 1999. How about reading or putting something about a placard about other things that God has to say? And yet this is in New Zealand. Adultery, you've got this concept. This particular recent case in the UK where a woman has just been given life for shooting her husband's lover. What should have happened according to the law of God is the husband should have been executed according to God's law. You go back and read what it says in the Pentateuch. The idea of this one here, vicar is the father of the organists. Love child. Not bastard. Love child. Be aware that this terminology is having an effect on us. It is not just going, you know, you might think, oh, it's not really having an effect. Owen's tear for baby Gemma Michael Owen and his girlfriend Louise posed for the first pictures of their baby daughter, 11-day-old Gemma. She was born in hospital. I shed a few tears. Liverpool and England striker said. Now, that the two aren't married, but they're going ahead and they're having a child. And presented perfectly natural, perfectly normal. Another one. Let's spare a thought for the mistress. In other words, what happens to these poor mistresses when the husband dies? You know, they can't grieve. You know, they've got to stay in the background. Let's have a thought for the mistress. And on and on and on it goes. Okay, so morality. Be aware that we are being influenced by this kind of thing. Another area, turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 3. And 2 Timothy chapter 3, I might go a little bit over time, but it says verse 1, it says, "This know also, in the last days perilous times shall come, for..." Now why is it going to be perilous times? "Because men shall be lovers of their own selves." Now there is something happening within society. The "I owe it to myself," or "because I'm worth it" society, you know, you see it all the time. It's there all the time. What's the terminology? What do they call this thing? Self-esteem. That's it, self-esteem. I want to read you something from somebody who is a prison psychologist. But the "me, myself and I" generation, in this kind of relationship campaign that we are in the throes of, notice down in verse 13, it says, "But evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived." So within this "me, myself and I," the men being lovers of their own selves, we must be aware that this is part of the media mix that Satan uses. It is part and parcel of it. Now, it comes out in all kinds of areas. It comes out in assertiveness. You know, if you're looking at assertiveness training, you probably have it in your businesses and so on. So that you have an assertive manager or assertive individuals, perhaps salesmen or whatever. If I can just read one little thing, and I don't want to tread on too many toes, but I do think this is all part and parcel of it. This is from Fly Lady. "As you all know by now, fly means finally loving yourself. Let me tell you why it was so perfect. 10 years ago, I started to practice something. At first, just in words to myself while I would meditate. I didn't have a mantra. I didn't even know what that was and didn't care. Still, a mantra is something you chant over and over again when you're meditating in Eastern religion. Still, somehow I knew I needed some words to help me focus, and I chose, I love myself. As I breathed in, I would say, I love, and as I breathed out, I would say, myself. And I'd say over and over, and eventually, each time I'd close my eyes, those words would suddenly pop into my mind." She was using it in that way. Now, the fly lady, the actual, you know, looking after the home and so on, is excellent. It's a mixture of good and evil. But when we are looking at this, this is not a new idea. This is a very, very old idea. I want to read something from the American Kang Duk Wong Karate Association. Some quotes. "For the uncontrolled there is no wisdom, nor for the uncontrolled is there the power of concentration. And for him without concentration there's no peace. And for the unpeaceful, how can there be happiness?" Now that's from the Hindu scriptures. You see, karate is a religion. Karate is part of the Oriental philosophy. Another one, "If you can dream, you can do it." Walt Disney, on the Karate Association. Another one, "The person who sends out positive thoughts activates the world around him positively and draws back to himself positive results." Norman Vincent Peale, the bootstrap philosophy, on a karate webpage. "As you go through life, don't practice subtraction, but instead add up your blessings, opportunities and possibilities. In so doing, you're relaxed, outgoing and successful." It is the Oriental idea. Emil Koo, Koe, is it Koe or Ku? I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it. Every day, in every way, I am getting better and better. Now, it's interesting. I don't know who this guy Koe was, or Ko, or Emil Ko, but he was back in the beginning of this century. This is written by a psychiatrist in prison. He says, in the prison work in which I work, I see many men who have a grossly inflated, indeed repulsive, self-image. They are young criminals who walk with a swagger, have frequently committed acts that have caused deep misery to others, who have fathered children without the least concern of their welfare, and yet who project a self-satisfaction that is horrible, at variance with their actual place in the world. So here's this doctor working with these people. The patient believes that it's the doctor who should somehow or other confer self-esteem upon them. A bit of a medal of an award ceremony. If he fails to do so, the doctor's responsible for the future dissatisfaction of the patient. We're back in the world of Emil Coue, the French psychologist who in the early part of the century advised his patients to repeat, every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better, 20 times in the morning and 20 times each evening. Nevertheless, people continue to die. He goes on a bit more. He says, reviewing such a patient's life, it's hardly clear that there are many grounds for the lack of self-esteem. Indeed, the end of the history-taking, it is clear that he doesn't think nearly ill enough of himself, that he's far worse than he supposed, that his alleged lack of self-esteem, the problem that he's laid before the doctor, is but a ruse to disguise for himself the extent of his own worthlessness. He's dealing with people in prison here. The doctrine of self-esteem to which everyone is entitled, then, is part of the philosophy of, quote, the real me, the inner platonic essence that is uncorrupted by the grosser phenomenal me. Now, this is where it's coming from. You see, it's interesting that I'm reading this thing on Fly Lady, that she's using it as a mantra. Why? Where is this coming from? Where does the concept come from? The me that behaves selfishly, that loses its temper, is dishonest and hits women or whatever vice it's given to. Many people come to me saying that they need to find themselves on the assumption that somewhere buried deep within them, like a vein of precious ore in the water swand, is a wonderful, exceptionally talented person trying to get out, with whom they'll be able to feel good, and the doctor is thus a miner of the hard rock of the personality. I sometimes astonish my patients by telling them that it's far more important that they should be able to lose themselves than they should be able to find themselves. For only in losing oneself that one does find oneself. You know, that's biblical, isn't it? But what is the message that comes across from the media? That we need to find ourselves and have self-esteem in that respect. Self-respect is possible for people in all walks of life and in almost all social conditions. I've been struck by the self-respect of many people in the slums of the developing world, where to appear in clean clothes represents a considerable achievement, a triumph of the human spirit over adversity. And I will second that, because I've seen the slums in Nigeria, and I've seen people come out of those dwellings where the sewage is running down outside, and they are immaculate, absolutely immaculate. You don't need to go ahead and have a mantra that causes this to be the case. You see, when we're looking at this particular subject, as he says, we're looking at a Platonic essence that is uncorrupted by the grosser phenomenal me. That is Oriental mysticism. And it is interesting that Mr. McNair, I always remember this particular case, that Mr. McNair came back to this country after the first baptizing tour into India that the church ever conducted. And he was accosted by a demon-possessed man, and he was told that they are leaving that area and they're coming west. Now that is significant. And immediately after that, you have the Maharishi, whatever he was, that suddenly appeared with the Beatles, and this suddenly society was transformed. What is happening in our society is not coming from human beings.
There is a marketing mix that Satan is using, and we in the church have got to understand this. We've got to be able to separate it out. This mantra, you know, every day in every way I'm becoming better and better, or whatever it happens to be, it's coming from a wrong source. And we've got to separate between what is right and what is wrong. Why do we fast? What do we fast for? Do we fast it to discover the real me? Yes, we do. But it's not the real me. You see, there's a problem. What happens is somebody's going down this track, and they're over here, and they feel dejected and miserable, and, you know, no, woe is me, I can't do anything, this is terrible, this is not the way it ought to be. So what they do is they go onto the other side, into the other ditch. They're on one ditch at the moment, and they go across this other ditch, and they say, I love myself, I can do this, I can do that, aren't I wonderful? What people don't understand is they're both off track, because both of them, one side is, can't do this, I can't do that, I'm no good, I am worthless. And the other track is, I am wonderful. It's all the I, myself, me. And that is the problem. And yet what does Paul say? He says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. The center changes from both ditches, which is selfish, to God-centeredness. That is what we should be doing. That is how we should be behaving. And getting that right and sorting all of this stuff out. You know, we are getting more and more, we are going further and further down these lines. I think I gave this last week in the news item, calling all trainee wizards aged 8 to 14. Somebody's running a book club and trying to get these, you know, again, it's Harry Potter stuff. This appeared in the paper, Prince charmed by a 10p good luck bracelet. This bracelet the Prince of Wales is wearing at the moment, it looks like a hippie bracelet. It actually was presented as a lucky charm by a member of the public during a walkabout in Bulgaria. And this apparently is supposed to be, according to the custom, is a talisman. You put it on in March, and you must not remove it until the wearer has seen the first swallow or stork of the summer. And that's why he's got it on. This kind of thing is happening all the time. We have, on the one side, we have evolution undermining God and the idea of the supernatural, and on the other side, we have the natural idea that we want supernatural things, and we have a need to worship the true God, and yet going in the wrong direction there. And the whole mix is there. Right, very quickly, very, very quickly indeed, the final point, the busy campaign. We're told, Mr. Armstrong, if you remember, when Mrs. Armstrong actually had a dream that was so impressive that it left her really wondering about, as far as, you mentioned in the autobiography, it's so realistic, seemed more like a vision. For two or three days afterwards, everything else seemed unreal, as if a daze, and only this extraordinary dream seemed real. So it was a very unusual dream that she had. And she talked to this angel, and it says, at that time, we've been going quite regularly to motion picture theatres, and she asked the angel if this were wrong. And he replied, Christ had important work for us to do, preparing for his coming. There would be no time for movies. And those are the days of the silent pictures and so on. I just wonder, do we really have time for the stuff that we still watch? I mean, I'm not suggesting that we don't, you know, watch Star Trek occasionally or whatever we happen to watch. Not necessarily Star Trek, is it? You don't like it, Star Trek. That's blown my sermon, is it? I'm a Trekkie. No, I'm not exactly. Depending on the Star Trek, sometimes they get switched off. I mean, sometimes they're not worth watching. But, people do. They like adventure. And the busy campaign, busy adventure, doing this, doing that, going there, doing that, computer games, videos, music in the background all the time. It stops us from thinking. We don't get off by ourselves. We do not have the time to think. We have children. We have all the various myriad of things. We've got work to do. We've got a house to do. All the myriad of things that we've got to do. And yet, you see, it talks about walking with God. About Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Isaac. They walked with God. You can go back and find them, the words that are mentioned there. We're told to teach children when you get up, when you sit down, Deuteronomy 6:4-7.
when they walk by the way.
We're told that those that walk with wise men will be wise. You can put this in your notes, Proverbs 13:20. But the companion of fools will be destroyed. We need to be aware that this marketing mix, this busy campaign, is influencing both ourselves and our children as well. It is having an effect on us all. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 9. Isaiah chapter 9. It says, verse 6, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given." Isaiah 9, verse 6. "And the government shall be upon his shoulder. His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." And it means an abundance. It means shalom. Abundance. It means quietness. It means an abundance as well. "Of the increase of his government and of peace, there'll be no end upon the throne of David and his kingdom to order it and establish it." I don't see the computer games that we've got today being there. I can't see it. I really can't. I always remember we were at a seminar one time, and there was this individual. We were having a meal around the table, and this individual who was leading the seminar, we were actually representing a company. And we got to talking about television and children's television, and he was asked by somebody, he says, "Well, what do you like, watch on television?" He says, "Well, we don't have a television." And I'm not sure whether I asked him or somebody asked him. He says, "Well, why don't you have a television?" And there's kind of a short pause. He said, "Well, as a born again Christian, I don't think it's compatible with my beliefs." Everything went very, very quiet. But, I was sitting there and I thought, hang on a minute, I'm the one that should have been holding to that. And I think back into our child, your childhood, the time when we had young children, and the times when we did actually have the courage to get rid of the television, peace descended on the house. And then it came back again. And our experience as a family has been that it does help to have the TV removed to give the peace, because there's a busyness. It allows us to actually teach our children. Now, don't be afraid to put it away, even just for a bit. Don't be afraid to do that. If you turn over to Matthew 25, a couple of scriptures now in closing. Matthew 25. I want you to notice what it says here. Matthew 25. See, as it said to Mrs. Armstrong, it says, look, you don't have time for this. Matthew 25. Verse 10, it says, "While they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those that were ready went in with him to the marriage, and the door was shut." Are we going to be ready? Now, I'm not going to go into this particular passage of the wise and the foolish virgins. I've heard several different renditions of this from Mr. Armstrong himself over the years. But I want you to notice that there's no, you can, whoever it's referring to, whether it's referring to the church overall, or whether it's referring to Laodicea by itself, or whoever it's referring to, notice what it says. It's those that were ready. Are we going to be ready? And it came afterwards, it said, other virgins saying, "Lord, open to us," but he says, "Truly I say to you, I don't know you." That was the problem. They were not in contact with God. The Spirit was not being flown, was not flowing. He didn't know them. If we're not taking the time, and really, you children over the internet and here, you children, allow your parents to go ahead and have some time in the morning. And allow your parents to have the time in the evening together as well. So it's quite difficult. Final scripture, 1 John, because this entire subject, it really revolves around the fact that we do need to keep in contact with God. We need to know him. We need to really know him and know where our strength is coming from. But 1 John chapter 5, let's have a look first of all, chapter 2. Verse 15, a couple of scriptures actually in John. 1 John 2, verse 15, "Don't love the world,
nor the things that are of the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father isn't in him. For all that's of the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but of the world. And the world passes away, and the lust thereof. But he that does the will of God stays forever. We need to get our, you know, get our focus correct in this area of the media. 1 John chapter 5, you go to chapter 5, and just notice the end of what it says. Verse 18, we know that whoever is begotten of God is not continually sinning, but he that is begotten of God keeps himself, and the wicked one doesn't touch him. That's what we're talking about. I pray not that you take them out of the world, but you keep them from the evil one. And it's a case of contact with God. And we know that we are of God, and the whole world lies in wickedness. It's an impossibility for the world to go in the right way, and the media that's coming out of that world will be leading in the wrong direction. And we know that the Son of God is come and has given us an understanding that we may know him that is true, and that we are in him that is true, even in his Son, Jesus Christ. This is the true God and eternal life. It'll lead to inexorably to eternal life. Little children, keep yourself from idols. Amen. And the word amen shows us the concluding statement of this book. The problem is, there are idols. And within the media, that is in fact what Satan would like us to get hold of. It's what we really do need to guard against. Quite a few.